Good evening, everybody. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, and this is for July 25th, 2024. First of all, I just want to remind you about the television show that airs Tuesday evenings, just to make sure you are aware of this. To come here every week, this is Tuesday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and all the archives are, you can find where they're listed. There's probably 20 platforms out there where these shows are then archived. So look on my webpage, jmccsci.com, and also mention that these shows are informational. They do not go into depth about my theoretical work, which is extensive. And so if people are watching this, this is to give you an incentive to go to my webpage, where there's going to be a lot more material and just a tremendous amount more material. And if people are scientists who are interested in learning more about my work, or maybe they already know something but they want details, this show is not the place to try and, say, get details and provide commentary or something like that. It's simply not meant for that. It's meant to give an overview, and then go to the webpage once again, jmccsci.com. That's short for J. McCanny Science, which is the webpage which has been there for since the 1990s, literally, and probably about 15 gigabytes worth of information. Also, every week I'm going to talk a little bit about the science industry, and that's literally what it is. It's an industry, and it's run by money and fame and profit and egos. Let's put it that way. There's a lot of ego in science. People call themselves the elite as if they were intellectually elite. And I'll tell you, that's not true. Because I know a lot of people, I've met a lot of people who are very good scientists, and I've met a lot of scientists who've gotten a PhD and think they're smart, but they're not. They've learned a lot of incorrect science, basically. And that's coming out of the woodwork right now. The idea that, for example, the Big Bang is going away. And anybody who has the fantasy that that's not going away, is they're lost in their little university ivory tower. Another theory, that the solar system began 4.5 billion years ago and nothing really has happened since, that all the planets formed. Complete nonsense. There are so many, there's dozens and dozens of very simple proofs that that isn't true. Saturn, for example, has 27 moons of its fleet of moons. 27 of them are not original. So there are processes by which new planets, new moons coming into the solar system can become circularized, their orbits circularized. And I talk about that in my work, in my scientific work, how this process works and the formation of moons and planets, etc. So we have new moons and new planets in the solar system. In fact, the only original planet, which is not really a planet, in the original solar system was Jupiter. Everything else after that was captured, including Saturn, even the big planets. And by the way, Jupiter and Saturn are not planets. They're small stars. And they actually have ongoing fusion in their atmospheres. So that's a topic I talk quite a bit about. But the thing I want to mention specifically is that in around 1979, Carl Sagan became a movie star. He went to Hollywood and basically with his secretary at the time, later his wife, Ann Druyan, presented all this material that was standard science. And before that, the problem was that there was really no standard story. So they had to put it together. So Carl became a movie star because he held the banner, he rode the white horse, he got all the scientists together and said, okay, we got to come up with a pat story here. because what was going on was the news media was clamoring on the scientific world. And the reason for that was because a guy named Emanuel Velikovsky was selling millions of books in translated into 14 languages. And so the news media went to the scientific community and said, well, you're up in arms against this guy saying what he's saying couldn't be true. And by the way, Velikovsky was not a scientist, nor was he trying to be. What he was doing was he was interpreting ancient texts and showing that Venus was a comet. It was literally captured by Jupiter by a capture process, and I talk about that in my theoretical work. But the whole idea of a comet being big and coming in and then nestling in to become a planet was outrageous to the scientific community. And so Sagan, in his righteousness and with mustering all of the support from various fields, anthropology, geology, etc., got all these people together and came up with standard answers. Mind you, this is before the space program. So they actually were doing this in the 1970s, before we really had good data from space probes that approached the big planets out there. Like I say, Jupiter and Saturn are unlit stars. And so they created all this theoretical work, and it turns out that not a piece of it is correct. None of it is correct. But that is the hierarchy. That's the pinnacle. That's the top echelon. That is the peak of the scientific world. So geology, meteorology, all kinds of other fields of study have to come and subordinate themselves to this idea that, and here's the key, that anything that happens, the Earth simply did it by itself. So tonight I'm going to be talking about a couple of things that we learn about from the ancient texts. And one of those ancient texts is the Old Testament of the Bible. One of those events was the Noah's Flood. And what do we learn from the Noah's Flood? From literally 200 cultures from around the world tell the same story, that there was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. So I'll be talking about that in detail. But it was torrential rain. So what do modern geologists talk about now, or meteorologists, or whoever wants to talk about it? They have to say, well, the Earth did all this by itself. And so, for example, they will say that, oh, that this was a land dam that broke, and there was a body of water, and it broke and rushed into the what is now the Mediterranean Sea, and that was the Noah's Flood. And so it wasn't torrential rain at all. They're saying it was just this dam breaking and then the flood moving. Well, it's really stupid, because if that were the case, why would Noah build this big boat to hold all the animals? It wouldn't make any sense. If that were the case, he would just walk up to the next hillside, and when the dam broke, he would be good to go. There would be no issue. There would be no reason for him to build a boat. And we know he built a boat, a big one, about a football field and a half long, and three-decker. This thing was a big boat. This held animals, and all the animals in the world, they say, or at least a good spectrum of the animals. But the way the Bible talks about it, Noah is the only guy on the planet that survives. And we know from other cultures that this flood was worldwide and a lot of people survived. And that's why, for example, China and India fared pretty well, because they lived up in the mountains, the people who survived it. And there were a lot of people that survived it in those regions. So they got a head start on the population. And that's why they have bigger populations today. The Western Hemisphere, where the United States became very populated because of basically waves, large waves of immigration from Europe initially, and then those people multiplied, and then United States has been the golden place to go in pretty much all the world. Everybody wants to go to the United States because that's the land of gold. That's where you go to become rich, to find your fortune, etc. Still going on today. But back to the idea of pinnacle science. The idea that these are I'll talk about what I've termed the axioms of astronomy. And actually, I got that term when I was at Cornell. I was involved in publishing my papers, my peer-reviewed papers. Some were getting published. And it drew the ire of the astronomical community there because they had just gotten done arranging all of this theoretical work. Finally, the probes were going out to the various planets, going out to Jupiter and Saturn, and beyond, going out to Venus. And all this data was coming in, and I'm there interpreting the data differently and saying, no, this is not what the data is saying. What the data is saying is that comets are not dirty snowballs, something we know for a fact today because NASA and the European Space Agency have landed on the nucleus of a comet. There's no water, there's no snow, there's no ice, and there's nothing coming off the nucleus. And the head of NASA science got up on a podium and he said, comets are not dirty snowballs. Yet, they still go on with this meme, you might call it, that comets are dirty snowballs. But anyway, once this pinnacle hierarchy dogma of science was initiated by Sagan back in, like I say, the late 1970s, the Cosmos series is the most watched television program in the history of the world. And the book that goes along with it is the most read book in the world, next to the Gutenberg Bible. And at some point, it will actually surpass the number of people viewing Cosmos, the book that came out of the Cosmos series with Carl Sagan as star. The Cosmos book is the most read book in the world. And that was the intent, to push that onto the public. And that's so-called science. Well, it's not. It's garbage. Not a single thing in it is true. And we know that now. The solar system was not formed all at one time. Comets are not dirty snowballs. The Big Bang did not happen. It's like everything is wrong. And the whole reason was because they went out and they made all these proclamations before the space probes went out and really started examining. And it was just beginning at that time, like 1979 to 81. And those were what I call the Cornell years. Those were the years I was there working and understanding that, yeah, all of the science they had presented was simply wrong. But today, what's going on is you have a science industry. Big money, telescope time, publishing peer-reviewed papers in the lofty peer-reviewed journals. And really, they have to keep this thing going. They have to keep beating the drum because I guess I would say a lot of it is ego, but there's other things going on, and I've talked about that on different venues before. And part of it is it's a control issue, and here's how it works. The world bankers who run the governments, run the CIA, control who wins elections in all countries, including the United States, yeah, for a long time. They control science. Now, if you're going to be somebody that's in control, what is the biggest thing? What's the number one thing that you're afraid of? Well, that's why the evening news is there, to make you worry about things. Oh, the jobless rate and the economy and the housing crisis and, on and on and on. That's the evening news. All the things you should be worried about. But the one thing the people in power are aware of is that all these people out there paying their house bill and their insurance and their car payment and everything else, the one thing they're all going to realize is if someday a big comet appears in the sky and is so big that they're going to go, wait a minute, this thing is out of control of anybody on this planet. Nobody on this planet has power over that thing. And so people would stop making their house payment. People would stop making their insurance payment. They would stop living the way they're living because something else is going to happen and they better get their act together and find a new way to live, or that thing up there in the sky, which the bankers and the government and the president and the Congress and the Supreme Court have no power over. That's what they're afraid of. So they have to keep this mantra going that comets are little snowballs. Oh, you know, it's pretty strange. It's pretty strange, but that's what's going on. So anyway, okay, so just a quick comment. In 2022, but in 2022, I took the entire year. So it would be approximately 52 weeks. I think there were 52 weeks, Thursdays in that year. But at any rate, I took every week of that radio show, 1 hour each week, and I talked about the history of my discoveries. And so that might give you an idea of the extent that if somebody's looking to understand my work, what they would have to go through to study that. And that's just the basics. That does not cover, that does not describe my work. That's simply the discussion of the discoveries and what the scientific community was like, with anecdotes going on at that time in history, because I think that's important for people to understand what was going on in the world of science during those years, all of those, you know, literally a five-decade span. So anyway, just remind people, and that is available on my webpage. Those shows are available on the, if you click on education at the top of the page and go there, you can find those. Also, I was talking about the real reason why science does not want to change. And typically one would think, well, as egos, you know, you have all this published material, the textbooks would have to change, you know, all of the news media would have to report this, you know. And but one time, it was back in the 1990s, I was on a radio show with a guy named Art Bell. He was a talk show host who built up his radio show out of his trailer house in Pahrump, Nevada. And I never met Art personally, like in the same room with him, but I was on his show many times. I was one of his regular guests back in the 1990s, and talking about all types of topics. We talked about the Russian space program, which I was an expert in, and other topics. And anyway, we got on to this topic, and he brought it up. He said, you know, that talking about my scientific work, he said, it's very clear that your comet model is correct. And we were discussing, well, why, he said, well, why isn't it being recognized in the press? And I said the same thing I was saying just a minute ago, that, oh, egos and all of this material in the peer-reviewed journals would have to be changed and sorted out, and most of it would be incorrect. The textbooks would have to change. And he said, no, he said, that's really not it. There's something else going on. And Art was probably one of the most perceptive people I've ever met in my life. He just could see through things. He could, and anyway, so he said, there's something else going on. And that made me think. And finally, I came to the conclusion that that's what it was, because the people that fund science, let's face it, are in the government, in the people running the government. A lot of people don't understand, but the CIA operates NASA. NASA is not this space agency. And what you see is tier two science. It's the garbage science they pawn off on the public. So when you go down to the Cape and you see the rockets going off, or the shuttle going off, or something like that, or the, you know, the new Armentis rocket, or the whatever it is, that's a smokescreen. That is. Let me tell you, I've been around and I know what I'm talking about. And by the way, I'll mention that too, that when I say something, It's because I know about it myself. It's not because I read about it on somebody's web page or read a book someplace or whatever. It's because I was there myself. I experienced it myself, and I know what's going on. So anyway, the bottom line is that the real space program you never see, believe me. And but getting back to the controllers, this all goes back, and it is all controlled by money. Now, if you are the richest person in the world or running the bank, which runs all the money in the world, you know, the Rothschild banking entity, which is the front organization for the Vatican Bank, if you looked at the hierarchy and the people that are in control, basically the CIA controlling the pretty much everything around the world, surreptitiously, of course, and including science, then the one thing the people in power want to make sure is they maintain their power, because they have all the money. They don't need more money. They own all the businesses. They own, you know, they control everything. So what do they really worship? What is their main goal? And that is power, to maintain that power. And so anyway, that is the end goal. And the one thing they know that the public would wake up in a New York second if some large object, and I'm not talking about some little asteroid that's going to come and hit Earth, or they talk about this asteroid 2029 that might come near Earth and that's all the big news, you know. No, I'm talking about big, big things. And they would come in the form of large comets, because anything large, including the Earth, Jupiter, all of these objects are discharging the solar capacitor, but something that comes in on an elliptical orbit discharges that solar capacitor much more and would become a comet. And now, last week I was showing a diagram on the cover of one of my books with the nucleus of the comet very visible, and this would have been potentially a Saturn-Jupiter-sized object as the nucleus of this comet. And if something that big comes near Earth, doesn't crash into Earth, just comes near, my original work, going back into the 70s, I talk about something called action at a distance. In other words, it doesn't have to hit you to do the damage. But the getting back to the control aspect of planet Earth here, the whole issue is that the controllers know that if the public, if you, the public, look up in the sky someday and see this giant raging comet, you're going to realize that those people over there running Washington, D.C. or wherever they are don't have any control over that, and they're going to lose their power. So they have to keep this ruse going that comets are little fluffy snowballs and they couldn't hurt a flea, except maybe once in a while they kind of crash into Earth and, you know, but that was billions of years ago. Don't worry about it. You know, that's what's going on. So that's why they have to keep this facade of garbage science that they pawn off on you, the public. Okay. So anyway, the first science topic I want to cover here is dealing with weather. And the reason is because most people is very close to your daily life. So that's what I want to bring this topic back to down to planet Earth from outer space. And how does this work? Well, I have a book. It's called Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. And in there, I begin the book actually by saying that if it were not for electrical conditions in the solar system, we would not have any weather at all. We would not have clouds, we would not have wind, we wouldn't have hurricanes or tornadoes, we wouldn't have rain, we wouldn't have anything. Because the sun coming in, this is what meteorologists actually will tell you, is that the sun coming in heats up the atmosphere, and that causes all the weather, the lightning, the, you know, you have clouds, they say, rub against each other, and that causes lightning. Just absolutely absurd, because there's no physics involved at all in any of that. It's just fairy tale science. Because what would really happen if the light from the sun were the only effect that we had coming in on planet Earth, because the Earth spins around on its axis every 24 hours. And so the sunny side of Earth, the side towards the sun, gets a dose of sun, and then it goes dark for 12 hours or 8 hours, depending on if you're in the northern climate or the southern hemisphere, depending on the time of year, the seasons, etc. But basically, it heats up when the sun is shining, it cools down when it's nighttime. And in the winter time, the sun gets lower on the horizon, so you get less sun, longer nights, colder weather. Pretty simple, except the sunlight, the idea that that somehow creates all of these weather conditions like hurricanes and, wind, etc., is just fantasy. Because what you would have for weather if the light from the sun were the only thing coming in to the planet, the only weather you would have a little bit of mild wind at what is called the terminator. And I'm not talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm talking about there's a line where the sun, the sunny side of Earth meets the dark side of Earth. That's called the terminator line. And you would have a little bit of breeze there. That's it. You wouldn't have clouds. You wouldn't have rain. You wouldn't have, literally all the weather you see. You certainly wouldn't have lightning. You wouldn't have clouds, whatever. You wouldn't have any weather at all. So the bottom line is that all of the weather on planet Earth, literally all of it, comes from electrical conditions in the solar system. Well, how does that work? What's the power source? And it turns out that the sun has a lot more electrical energy coming out of it than it does invisible light. And so what happens is there's an excess current of protons that creates a capacitor. The Earth and all the other planets are discharging that capacitor. And that electrical current is what drives the, let's just take it from the top down. There's a magnetic field that blocks the solar wind, and that's about 30,000 miles out to the sunward side. So what's going on? The solar wind comes in, sees this magnetic field, and it splits. The electrons go one way, the protons go the other way. And so that creates a battery. That's a battery, okay? Very simple. You have a magnetic field, you have solar wind coming out, protons and electrons. When the protons and electrons see the magnetic field, the protons go one way, the electrons go the other way. And that creates a battery. And that battery then can discharge with Earth right in the middle. So a number of things happen. We also have something called the Van Allen belts that surround Earth. They're co-rotating belts of electrons and protons, high energy protons and electrons. That's part of the magnetic field. It's a plasma magnetic field. Okay, so then that couples with the upper atmosphere, and we have co-rotating bands of electrical current up in the upper atmosphere. Another electrical effect, part of the electrical current that's driven by the sun. Okay, what do those currents do then? They drive the lower belt or the lower atmosphere, what we call the jet streams, which are lower in the atmosphere. And then eventually those work along with low pressure and high pressure cells and other surface phenomenon to give us weather patterns and wind currents, etc., which come down to the troposphere. And when you have hurricanes, when you have tornadoes, that's actually a discharge between the Earth and the ionosphere, which is literally an ionosphere. So anyway, I'll talk in a minute about the belts and how those come into play in terms of weather. And for example, one of the best examples is to explain how hurricanes form. And that'll give you, they're probably the biggest, ugliest weather systems that we have. And they're also coupled with tornadoes. The leading edge of a hurricane, there's hundreds and hundreds of tornadoes, and that's typically what does most of the damage, although people don't realize that because it's just windy. It's a lot of wind. And anyway, I'll talk about that, how lightning forms and above the clouds and below the clouds. And that should have been the key all along, is originally people thought that lightning came out of the bottom of clouds and somehow there was some interaction in the clouds, molecules rubbing against each other that created electric charge and the energy comes shooting out the bottom of a cloud. That's not what's going on. The cloud is simply an intermediary between the ground and the ionosphere, and now it is well known that there's lightning above the clouds too. Well, how do clouds form electrical energy and then the electrical energy comes shooting out? It's silly science. So it's what's really going on is this is part of the overall electric field. When I talk about topics on this show, remember that this is a overview for the public. And to get a deeper understanding of the concepts, the science behind this, you have to go to my webpage where there's a lot of information. There are books. There's a lot more detailed information. And for scientists, once again, even there's information beyond what's available on the webpage. The webpage is primarily for the general public. Once again, that webpage is jmccsci.com. Okay, so talking about weather, one time I was in the Caribbean and I was looking out over the ocean, walking along the beach, and out over the ocean were two water spouts. And these two water spouts are probably, they look like maybe a mile high, very tall, very thin, and they just kind of like move along the water, kind of wiggling. And but what causes that? There were no clouds. There was just, it was just like a hazy day. And but what powers those? They just don't exist. They just don't come out of nowhere. And actually, it's the same power source that drives hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. It's an electrical discharge to the vertical electric field that goes all the way up to the ionosphere. This is what Tesla was tapping into, by the way, at his Wardenclyffe Tower and at his Colorado Springs facility. So basically, getting back to this magnetic field, that's a plasma magnetic field that is around Earth, the electrical currents from the sun passing by create this charge separation, which drives the magnetic fields. And Earth's upper atmosphere has counter-rotating bands of electric current. And there's two at one at each pole. And typically that's where the auroras occur, but it's literally called the ring current. And then mid-latitude, there's another set of ionospheric ions that are in a band of current up in the ionosphere. And then at the equator is an electron belt which goes in the opposite direction. These are co-rotating, but counter-rotating. The positive ions go one direction, the electrons go the other direction, and basically provide the charge that powers the atmosphere. So when you see lightning, it's literally the cloud. All it's doing is acting as a conduit between the ionosphere and ground or the ocean or wherever the lightning is occurring. But the other thing, there's a little bit of physics involved in clouds, and scientists are trying to go up, they're flying in clouds, storm clouds, to try and understand if there's electrical generation going on in the clouds. And when they get into the clouds, there's zero electric field, and that's exactly what you would expect. Because if you have take a conductor, like say a steel ball, you put it in an electric field, and you measure the electric field inside the steel ball, it will be zero. That's just a basic electromagnetism physics problem. Because what happens is the charge populates the outside edge of the steel ball to balance the charge in the electric field that's outside. And the end result is zero electric field inside the steel ball. Same thing happens with a cloud. So there's no electricity forming in the middle of a cloud. It's zero. And what happens is you get the charge forming on the upper side and on the lower side. And then when the electrical discharges occur between the ionosphere and ground or the ocean, whatever's below the cloud, that is the electrical circuit. Now, it's an electrical circuit, but it's complete. And the idea that electricity just shoots out of a cloud is absolutely absurd. Take a battery, you know, like a flashlight battery, and hold it in your hand, Mr. Scientist who thinks that clouds generate electricity and lightning just shoots out of it. Take any battery and hold it in your hand and wait until it discharges out the ends of the battery. And you're going to be waiting a very long time, pretty much for infinity, because batteries discharge internally, not externally, unless you put a wire there and cause it to discharge. But anyway, getting back to the reality of hurricanes, so these storm systems are moving across Africa, and they have ground below them, physical ground, Africa. And so the lightning discharge between the ionosphere through the clouds down to ground have a complete circuit. But as soon as those move out over the Atlantic Ocean, there's no longer ground down there. All you have is the surface of the ocean. So what happens is it ionizes the air at the surface of the ocean, and that ionized air, positively ionized air, starts moving up because the band of electric current around the equator is electrons, it's negative. And so those ions start rising up, and when they rise up, they start to turn. That's the Coriolis force, the Coriolis effect. It's like water going down the drain in the bathtub and it starts twirling, except in this case, it's going up and it starts spinning, and that's what forms the eye of the hurricane. And you can watch these form. You can watch the very tallest cumulonimbus cloud as they roll off of Africa, and that's where the eye is going to form, because that's where the electrical discharge is going to connect the quickest and the most propensity to connect to the vertical electric field. And once that process starts, then it's draining energy from the ionosphere to the ground, and that's what drives the hurricane. And the reason the hurricane moves west is because you have an electric current that is vertical, and if you take the positive current and you take the physics right-hand rule, the magnetic field is going north, then the force is in the westerly direction. And that's why hurricanes move to the west, is because it's a electric current cross B field force. And so anyway, that's the fundamental nature of hurricanes. They don't form because of warm water. That is the most ridiculous ploy that I've ever heard. I mean, that it violates the three laws of thermodynamics. Basically, thermodynamics says that you cannot take a body of warm water, and then all of a sudden this storm spontaneously generates into a hurricane, and then drives energy into it to sustain it. Absolutely can't possibly work. But I've seen people, I saw a guy from MIT write an article about how this supposedly drives hurricanes through entropy. But what he forgot to do was calculate the amount of energy that it takes. And if you do the energy calculation, there's no way that a warm body of water can generate a hurricane. Absolutely absurd. But anyway, that's what they'll tell you on the evening news about, oh, the warm water. This year we have warm water and there's a little more salt content. Ooh, we're going to have big hurricanes this year. Absolutely absurd. In fact, it's interesting that the guy who invented all that silly science, his last name was Dr. Gray, I think William Gray, got up on a podium decades ago, 1999, I believe, and he said, basically, all of this hurricane prediction science is garbage, and he quit, and his right-hand man quit. But these hurricane prediction centers funded by you, the public, continue to operate with this silly science. That's the best thing you can call it. Okay, so let's get on with the Noah's Flood. I know a lot of you are interested in this, and it's really a very interesting story that comes. The Noah's Flood is out of the Bible, and the ancient flood comes from at least 200 cultures from around the world. They talk about the same thing. And a lot of them have figurative speaking, so they'll have characters that went up into the sky and caused the rain to fall, etc. But when we're talking about torrential rain, we're talking about rain that is so intense. And I've been in rain like this in the tropics, in the jungle. Sometime it'll be raining so hard you can't even breathe, hardly. That's how hard it's raining. And that's how hard it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, there again, 40 days and 40 nights in biblical terms is figurative. So we really don't know. You don't take that literally, but 40 was the number that used to be used in ancient times. You find it reoccurring in the Bible many times, like Christ went into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. That's not a literal number. What it means is that was kind of like their billion. If somebody wants to give you a big number today, oh, a billion. Oh, that's big. That's bigger than most people can imagine. 40 in ancient biblical times was the biggest number they could imagine. And so 40 days and 40 nights was just a long time when it rained and it didn't stop day and night for a long time. And it could have been about 40 days and 40 nights. But to be very clear, it was not some kind of, there are people like if you watch the Russell Crowe movie about Noah, all of a sudden the water starts shooting up out of the ground. No. There are artesian wells, there are situations where water can come out of the ground, but you're not going to have 200-foot ocean rise level rising from water coming out of the ground. It's simply not going to happen. And that's what happened during the Noah's flood. We had hundreds of feet, literally, that the ocean levels rose. But let's talk about Noah himself. He had forewarning that something was going to happen, and it took years to build the ark. It was a gigantic boat. This was, 150 yards long and a big, wide, very heavy boat. There was no motor and there was no sails. The whole purpose of this boat was to float. And they used, the way they stabilized it was with sea anchors and big rocks as anchors. So if they could anchor at some place and it was raining, then all they had to do was just stay pointed into the wind and they would be safe. That would be the best way to ride out this storm. And so what literally happened is Earth passed through the tail of a very large comet. And now I did some calculations, and if you look at the comet Hale-Bopp that appeared in the skies in the mid-1990s. It was a medium-sized comet. It was a big comet compared to most comets, if you compared it to, say, Halley's Comet. And by the way, NASA lied about the size of the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. It was very large. It was planetary in size. And there's a lot of ways to understand that. One of them is that the companion had orbital characteristics that would allow you to calculate the mass of the nucleus, the main nucleus. And there was a big hullabaloo about the idea that there was no companion to Hale-Bopp. But I'll just remind people, if you want to research this, go to the Canary Island Conference, sponsored by the European Space Agency, and all they talked about was the companion. These were the science meetings, but in the public they said Hale-Bopp did not have a companion. But if we had passed through the tail of Hale-Bopp, through the thickest part, it would have taken us about 40 days and 40 nights, and we would have had torrential rain. Just want to remind you that I have a CD on my webpage, and it's the title is The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters. And one of the topics is the Noah event, which I'm talking about now, but then I go into a whole series of other ancient disasters that were caused by celestial events. I want to remind you that science is trying its best to make the Noah's flood seem like something that Earth did all by itself. And you'll see that any time you find that explanations, about, oh, the water just came out of the ground, or it was a dam that broke in the Mediterranean and flooded into the Mediterranean. All of those are efforts to obfuscate the real situation that the Noah's flood was torrential rains for a long period of time. This on a worldwide scale. So I want to talk also about the continental shelves. Now this is very interesting because if you take, for example, the eastern seaboard of the United States and you wrap around Florida and through the Gulf of Mexico, around to the Yucatan Peninsula and around Belize and south, there's a continental shelf that extends very far out. And all of that in the time before Noah's flood would have been above water. So also we know from historical record that the earth was highly populated in those times before the Noah's flood. In fact, it's possible that it had a larger population than we have today. So, I always talk about the fact that archaeologists look at Göbekli Tepe or places like that that are, or even other ruins that are around planet Earth, and they talk about those being the hub of civilizations. And the reality is that the vast majority of archaeology has never been done because it's out on those continental shelves at the edge of where they drop off. The reality is that just like today, the vast majority of people lived very near the ocean, and that would have been the ocean at that time. So the other thing you can see, if you look at the underground topography on those continental shelves, there are traces of rivers that go out and then drop off at the edge of the continental shelf. And rivers don't form underwater. They form because of erosion and rain. So that's just proof that the continental shelves are full of, there were areas that were dry land at one time prior to the Great Flood. So the other thing that happened during the Great Flood was glaciation. There was a period of time when the sun was blotted out, so the earth got rather cold, in addition to all the water coming in. So you have to understand that the earth was very different. Russia took it upon themselves to drill a very deep hole into the earth, and they went down, I believe, about 20 kilometers. 7 kilometers down, they found water, and they also found the fossils of marine life 7 kilometers down. And that tells you that the earth has been building up and changing for, you know, we don't know. We really cannot tell how old the earth is. This idea that people pick up rocks on the surface and go, oh, the earth is 4.5 billion years old, is absolutely, once again, silly science. The rocks on the surface of the earth have nothing to do with the age of the earth, just like bringing moon rocks back. I talked about that on a previous show, that if you pick up rocks on the surface of the moon, they have absolutely nothing to do with the age of the moon, because it's all material that had fallen in over time from someplace else. So picking up moon rocks is one of the most silly science endeavors that ever crossed the plate of the human being. Okay, so the point is that we know very little about the human past. But one thing is very clear, is that man in his current form goes way back. At least, as far as we can tell, 10,000 years. But most estimates will put man in his current form back potentially hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, living on this planet. And during those times, there were many, many grave events, let's just put it that way, caused by celestial events, some of them with asteroids hitting. But I want to mention, too, about the supposed demise of the dinosaurs, that when researchers finally went back to that crater that's right off the Yucatan Peninsula, southeastern Mexico, and looked, that the dinosaurs did not even die off there. They survived and were prospering on top of the crater. So that crater did not kill the dinosaurs worldwide. That's a myth. There was something happened to the dinosaurs, and it was a major event, but it was caused by a large comet passing by Earth, because the other thing that happened is the atmosphere changed by a great deal. And that's what happens during these cometary passages. If they're close enough, the atmosphere has a significant change also. Okay, so this brings up another topic here in the modern world. And here's what's going on. It's kind of a subtle but very dangerous issue. Here we've got people who believe that we have to get rid of CO2 in the atmosphere. And I actually was in a competition, an XPRIZE competition. It was funded by Elon Musk. And the idea was to remove CO2 to get back to the 1880 level of CO2. But to do that, the another thing that you have to do besides sequestering CO2 is you have to release the oxygen back into the atmosphere, because then you would have a balance of oxygen. And it's really not much if you look at the entire amount of oxygen difference, because the level of CO2 right now is like 0.004% of the atmosphere. It's very, very little, and it's amazing that plants even grow at all. But here's the problem. What I discovered is, yes, you can effectively and in large quantities remove CO2 from the atmosphere. There are billions and billions of dollars being invested in this. And so these are investments that want a return, what's called ROI, return on investment. And so as these businesses get funded and grow, they have to return the money to the investor. Now, the investor doesn't really realize that there's a limit to the amount of CO2 that you can take out of the atmosphere, because you have many companies doing this, and they're doing it very effectively. And most of them don't return the oxygen to the atmosphere. They just remove the CO2 and they combine it, say, for example, in cement or into rubber that makes shoes or something. But they don't release the oxygen, the O2, back into the atmosphere when they break the carbon off. So the end result is that they're not getting back to that original state of the atmosphere in 1880. But let me talk about the time when the dinosaurs were around. Now, how much food does a dinosaur eat? That's kind of like, could be like a little kid's rhyme. How much food could a dinosaur eat if a dinosaur had big feet? Lots. The dinosaurs had to consume vast amounts of vegetation, and in the world today, there is no place at all, including the Amazon jungle, that would sustain dinosaurs, let alone woolly mammoths, which were much smaller animals. And it's not just one or two, it's like whole vast herds of these things, millions of them, all over the earth. And so the CO2, what it does is it promotes plant growth. Here's the problem with what's going on today, sequestering CO2 and taking it out of the atmosphere. Number one, these companies are not going to stop when we get back to 1880. They're going to go, we got to keep making money. And so they're going to keep removing CO2 until we have a desert around the world. The other problem is that in 1880, what people are not counting on is we had vast forests that covered the entire United States from the Mississippi River east was forest. And that was sequestering those trees, all of that forest was sequestering CO2 and turning it into carbon, which then decayed and fell on the ground and became very rich dirt, which is all gone now. It's all dried up and blown away after farmers intensively farmed, etc. And so what's going to happen as they start removing CO2 from the atmosphere, instead of lowering the temperature, it's going to make it more difficult for plants to grow. And the sunlight is going to hit the ground, and it's going to make it near impossible for plants to grow, causing desertification. And this is the end result. So they're playing with something they don't understand. And it's like so much crazy science today they people get it, it's I call it emotional science. People get all riled up and they're going to do this and they're going to run out. And how many times have you heard, you know, follow the science, you know, you have to listen to the science. And people finally have gotten wise to that, that the scientists, in a lot of cases, don't know what the heck they're doing. And CO2 removal is one of them. So we could end up with vast levels of desertification, that is making desert, on planet Earth. And once that happens, you're not going to get it back. This is happening in very short order. So I just want to mention that, that this is a very grave problem. The only plan for removing CO2 from the atmosphere is literally to have increased animal growth because the animals breathe out the CO2 and then increased forest production. And that was my plan to accomplish this goal. But what I learned as being a member of one of the teams, or having my own team actually, in the XPRIZE, is that most of the teams are not going to return the oxygen. They're going to sequester CO2, and they're depending on an ROI to investors that are not going to be able to stop economically once they hit the wall of back to the 1880 level. And they're going to do it, and then they're going to keep going until they take all the atmosphere CO2 out of the atmosphere. This is really bad bongos. So I just want to let you know that this is a very serious situation, and I don't know how to stop it. You can't, once these things get going, they gain a life of their own, and you can't stop it. Take a second to check out the webpage, jmccanniescience.com. The short URL is jmccsci.com. My latest release, eDVD, Eclipse the New Cosmology, goes through all of the things that you have to know to understand this radical change that is really taking place right now, and with the Big Bang simply going away overnight, something I did not expect. We knew 50 years ago that the Big Bang did not work, but finally the James Webb Telescope data is putting it to rest. Go visit the webpage, jmccsci.com. So anyway, we'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.